Well, good morning. My name is Trone Jacobson. I'm a doctoral candidate at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. This is the Emerging Archivist Paper Session. In some sense, I think it is not only that, but also an Emerging Archival Scholars presentation. Each of the papers presented here today, I think, will be provocative, and I hope it elicits a great deal of discussion and question. A couple of additional comments before I introduce the presenters today. The first is, although it's not really the norm in our field, I couldn't help but notice, given the number of submissions, that the selectivity rate for these presenters is quite impressive compared to many other comparable disciplines. This is the best of the best of many fine submissions. So I'll introduce the folks here. But please save your questions until the very end. We'll go through all three speakers. And then when you do, please identify yourself so that we know who you are. And I want you to know that the entire session is going to be recorded and then will be available in the future as well. So our first presenter today is Sarah Minigar, and she is the archives technician and museum educator at the Morristown National Historic Park, where she manages the Lloyd W. Smith Archival Collection and the Primary Source Seminar Archival Tutorial Program. She's currently pursuing her PhD in Modern History and Literature at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. And she completed her archival coursework at the United Methodist Archives Center on the Drew University campus. Her paper highlights the first year and a half of the Primary Sources Seminar Archives Tutorial Program and the successes and roadblocks that she has encountered as it has developed and as it has become, in her estimation, an increasingly valuable educational asset. Our second speaker is Adam Jansen, and he is a PhD student at the University of British Columbia School of Library, Archival, and Information Studies. Prior to moving to Vancouver and joining the UBC community, he spent 7 years working for Washington State, first at managing the enterprise-wide imaging program at the Department of Retirement, and then building the Washington State Digital Archives as the Deputy State Archivist for the State of Washington. He has received many certifications and recognitions, including CRM, MCP, MIT, CDIA, and an MS in Business Administration and Computer Science from Eastern Washington University. I believe that's in Cheney, Washington.
Very good.
He's going to be talking about his experiences with the Digital Records Forensics Project at UBC, which is a 3-year collaboration between the University of British Columbia's School of Library, Archival, and Information Studies, the UBC Faculty of Law, and the Computer Forensics Division of the Vancouver Police Department. The research that he'll be referring to in the paper addresses the many challenges presented by digital technology to the records management, archival, and legal professions, among them the identification of records among all of the digital objects produced by complex digital systems, and the determination of their authenticity in order to identify, develop, and organize the theoretical and methodological content of this new discipline called Digital Records Forensics. Our third and final speaker is Dharma Ackman, who is a doctoral student at the University of Michigan School of Information. And I'm glad that you're here. I know you're working on your prelim exams, and so it's great to have you here. Her broad research interests are in digital preservation, but in her recent research, she's been examining how scientists' data practices influence continuing access by others to data over time. Her co-author is also here. Morgan Daniels is another doctoral student at the School of Information at the University of Michigan, but we'll be hearing only from Dharma. The paper that she'll be talking about presents the research that the two of them have been gathering from a study of the data practices of a lab group of materials scientists. In their study, they conducted a series of interviews and observations for the purpose of understanding how those scientists document their data for use at a later time. So we will proceed through them all, and please hold your questions until the very end. And I look forward to what no doubt will be three fine presentations.
Good morning. I come to you today as a graduate student of history, an archivist, and a museum educator. I found my way into the archival world through my own study of primary documents, and have since discovered the perfect marriage of my teaching, research, and leadership skills in my work at the Morristown National Historical Park. During the summer of 2007, I was hired to process and rehouse the Lloyd W. Smith Archival Collection. In the fall of 2008, my curator approached me about developing an educational program that would utilize the Smith Collection. and I've spent the last 2 years cultivating this project. Today, I would like to share my experiences as a case study for other startup archives-based educational programs. Developing an educational program from scratch is a project not without its own complexities. Here, I will share in detail the successes and roadblocks of the Primary Source Seminar Archives Tutorial Program. Since its inception in 2008, the Primary Source Seminar has grown into an increasingly valuable educational asset for our park and for our library and archives. We've had the fortune of hosting 9 student seminar classes, 2 teacher workshops, and 4 special programs. Over 370 individuals have participated in an activity or program developed through the Primary Source Seminar, a great accomplishment considering the size of our department. Our curatorial staff consists of 2 full-time employees and 2 part-timers. I am one of the part-timers. We are also staffed by occasional interns, volunteers, and summer seasonals. The Primary Source Seminar, initiated by my curator and me, is run exclusively within our department. I am the coordinator, lead teacher, lesson developer, marketer, graphic designer, program liaison, publicist, blog designer and writer, teacher, workshop instructor, and a whole bunch of other things. The list goes on. I am also the processing archivist, the database manager, and the reference librarian for our library and archives. In small institutions, we take on many roles. I mention these roles to illustrate the reality in most small museums, libraries, and archives. Orders are tall, while staffing is short. I also mean to illustrate another point. Even while operating within staffing, budgetary, and resource constraints, new and innovative educational programs can thrive. Since the spring of 2009, we have grown from a 2-component program consisting of student seminars and teacher workshops to a much larger program. Last summer, we added a Primary Source Seminar blog, which provides connections to digital primary resources, program information, and mini lessons, which highlight the documents from our collection. We've also begun an in-house teacher reference shelf and a traveling archives program, which allows teachers to take scanned documents and lesson plans we have developed into their classrooms. This summer, utilizing a National Park Foundation grant, we are developing an Archival Ambassadors Program. Our Archival Ambassadors Program will entail a graduate-level internship and a collaborating high school stewardship component. I will focus now on specific points of the development in the Primary Source Seminar Archives Tutorial Program. For the sake of time, I have chosen to speak on just 3 points. I will begin with the ways in which we determined an educational need at Morristown. Historically, our park has provided educational opportunities for all ages through exhibitry, our historic buildings and structures, and through our interpretive programs. We have given special attention to researchers and scholars, utilizing our manuscripts and our library collections. And we have provided workshop opportunities for the community. We have also run a successful elementary education program for many years. While our galleries and tours are intended for general audience enjoyment, our most underserved group was by far high school-aged learners. Once we identified this need, my curator and I began pondering ways to bring high school learners into our institution. We wanted to present an educational opportunity like no other. We wanted to incite passion in young historians through the primary documents that bring history to life. My curator proposed an educational program utilizing our diverse archival collections, and from there, I began developing the Primary Source Seminar. There were, of course, roadblocks. On paper, this initiative seemed very simple, but the planning ahead would be very demanding. We went into this knowing our primary staff would only include the 2 of us. We would be working on a shoestring budget, and that a project of this magnitude would entail personal time and resources. Since the benefits, in our estimation, outweighed the strains, we proceeded to move ahead and enlist the support of our colleagues and superintendent. I put together a program proposal, and luckily it was met with much enthusiasm. Identifying an educational need may not be as clear for some as it was for us. Conducting surveys and assessing current educational programs are effective ways to begin the process. From its inception, it was intended that the Primary Source Seminar to utilize in various capacities the Lloyd W. Smith Archival Collection for our student seminars and teacher workshops. The Smith Collection includes approximately 15,000 printed works and nearly 300,000 manuscripts spanning from the 15th through the early 20th century. This collection is not a typical Park Service collection. The archives houses everything from George Washington to Booker T. Washington, Alessandro Scarlatti to Richard Wagner, Byron to Longfellow, George III to George Eliot, Darwin to Emerson, Catherine D. Medici to Susan B. Anthony. The Smith Collection is an amalgam of founding fathers, U.S. and world leaders, authors and poets, scholars and thinkers, social activists, celebrities, and laypersons. From this collection, we selected Native American, African American, and women's documents, content that falls under the thematic unit we have chosen, Exploring Human Rights in America. The majority of the documents in our collection are quite stable, as they are properly housed and only occasionally accessed and handled. For this reason, we made the decision to pull original manuscripts for portions of our seminar and our workshop meetings. We feel the educational experience is enhanced greatly by the introduction of authentic historical materials. While we pull primary documents for viewing, high-quality scanned images are used for the majority of our analysis activities. After carefully assessing the manuscript collection, I selected documents that help facilitate discussions of human rights, and those documents are put on a rotated viewing schedule. Handling during the educational program is minimal, but we do realize that exposure to light and inexperienced hands can be detrimental. For this reason, we carefully monitor our manuscripts during use and inspect them after each session. Delicate items are kept in polyester sleeves at all times. Each seminar session highlights a different manuscript, so this also allows us to minimize the handling and exposure as well. Since our initial plan was to design a program to bring historical documents out of archival storage and into the hands of young learners, our objective was to have high school students practice document analysis activities using authentic, unedited 18th and 19th century manuscripts from the Smith Collection. With this objective in mind, I began developing lesson plans and activities geared toward 9th through 12th grade students. To ensure the lessons would be grade level and content appropriate, I referenced the Advanced Placement U.S. History, or APUSH, guidelines and the National History Standards for grades 9 through 12. Both of these guides are free and available online. I also reviewed the New Jersey Core Curriculum Standards, and in New Jersey those are our educational competency standards, because most of the participants in our schools, in our program, are located in New Jersey. Because we also offered teacher workshop opportunities, I registered the primary source seminar as a professional development provider, thus allowing teachers to simultaneously receive professional development credit for their participation in our workshops. Once I had begun creating lessons and had outlined a teacher workshop agenda, I consulted with several local history teachers to gauge student and teacher expectations and to test run my lesson ideas. The activities planned for our students included group and individual analysis activities. We focus on training students to look closely at primary documents and make observations about them. So we have them check out things like the things that are stated outright, things that are implicit, things that are revealed through tone and language, as well as things that are revealed through missing information. We have students make observations about a document's composition, their condition, their provenance, signs of use, wear and decay, etc. And students are then asked to interrogate the document to determine the subject, the occasion, the audience, the purpose, and the speaker of the document. Afterwards, students come down to the reading room in small groups and observe and analyze documents firsthand. I have a background in secondary and post-secondary education, so I was relatively familiar with lesson planning of this kind, but for those with little background, the National Archives and the Library of Congress have some excellent document-based lesson plans to use as a starter guide. We did encounter roadblocks during our first workshop and seminar sessions. Space was a major issue for us. Our only large group instruction area was under construction for the first year and a half of our program, which meant we had to manage traffic carefully by shifting and staging groups. This effort took much coordination and was immensely difficult with only two people supervising. Typical groups ranged from 30 to 60 people, and our comfortable and, I guess, legal library reading room capacity was only about 20. Because the reading room could not comfortably seat entire groups, we had to divide classes into two, and this juggling act led to a lot of downtime and unstructured waiting for students who were waiting to participate in the document activity. The room also became quite loud, and we found that teachers did not always discipline their students for inappropriate behavior. In the end, my curator and I were exhausted. We spent a lot of energy teaching, corralling bodies, giving tours, and policing manuscripts and cultural resources. We have since stressed the role of teacher and chaperone participation and involvement and have increased the required number of chaperones per visiting class. The completion of our auditorium late last summer alleviated our congestion problem. We can now complete a full seminar in approximately 2.5 hours. Had these two aspects not fallen into place, we might have had to restructure the classroom configuration or the program presentation entirely. Our first teacher workshop was not all smooth sailing either. For the first run, we took the solely informational route. We talked about our program, we gave an overview, we pulled interesting documents for viewing, etc. But we chose to keep it this way because without experience, we really couldn't gauge, you know, teacher needs. We knew that we were taking a risk by losing teacher interest by keeping it purely informational, but during that first session, we were able to collect teacher evaluations, and that proved immensely helpful in the development process of our subsequent workshops. Our latest workshop, and the one that we have planned for this fall, employed structured interactive activities. Each workshop has specific focus, and teachers and education majors practice a variety of primary source use methodologies during the workshop session. So the upcoming one is going to be teaching document-based questions, and we have an expert teacher in the community leading that session. And lastly, budgetary issues and limitations with staffing. Budgetary restrictions impede most institutions, but smaller libraries and archives tend to feel the impact hardest. As a federal institution, our park cannot acquire funds in the same way a private institution can. We are limited by strict fundraising regulations, and we have restricted federal grant eligibility. The only money Primary Source Seminar raises is a small operational fee we charge for student seminar classes. The cost per student comes out to about $2. All of our other programs are free to the public, which ultimately means we absorb all of the costs. And within our department, we must rely on our base budget for all of our supply and maintenance needs. And therefore, those are the necessities, and any extra programs, like educational programs, are really relegated to the leftovers. So our solution to these restraints is just creativity. For a Primary Source Seminar, no budget meant in-house development, self-promotion, and utilizing free or existing resources. Our primary resource, of course, was the Lloyd W. Smith Archival Collection. This collection was our guiding force. Of course, you know, we had this great collection that had the potential for so many thematic units, but our actual goal was to focus on modes of document analysis. The purpose of this endeavor is not to act as historical authorities or to seek definitive answers, but rather to inspire productive observation and inquiry generated through document analysis. And these observation and analysis skills can be practiced on any primary document, making an archives-based educational program even more feasible than one might at first imagine. Since climate control, storage, and basic preservation is generally included in a library archives-based budget, existing special collections tend to be somewhat free resource. Bells and whistles aside, one special collection tends to be the most important resource and educational tool available. If you have the documents available, you can teach a skill. Because we are a non-funded educational program, I've become quite good at improvisation. I'm getting familiar with the office tools that we have in-house. Although I have no training in graphic design or marketing, the in-house software has been essential to my ability to do things like enhance photos, create brochures, promotional posters, create mailing lists, logos, scan documents, prepare presentations, design worksheets, etc. We've been able to manage thus far without purchasing any additional software. As far as staffing goes, most recently, this summer, we've been able to bring some interns on, mostly education majors, both undergraduate and graduate level, to do some of the lesson developing, as well as a teaching fellow that we've brought in this year as well. When I discovered our existing park website could not support a separate web page for our program, I started a Primary Source Seminar blog utilizing a free blogger domain. This resource is our link to the public, and it is available at absolutely no additional operational cost. And so in order to achieve a successful educational program with a small budget and staff, sacrifices must be made. Personal time is a major factor beyond the workday. Time away from your main job is going to be inevitable, especially in the initial stages, and one will invariably be conducting a lot of self-training on your institution's in-house software. But I can say from experiences, the sacrifices are really well worth it. And if you feel that you're having a strain in starting up your own program at your institution, and you feel that it's really insurmountable, I really encourage you to keep trying, because even a very basic educational program will benefit your community. Developing an archives-based educational program is an enormous task, but the rewards are immense. I have witnessed young people experience those aha moments as they connect with history through primary sources, and it is those unique experiences that are remembered. The Primary Source Seminar has become a unique stewardship opportunity for our community, as it has fostered new relationships and it is cultivating a new generation of cultural heritage leaders. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm here to talk to you about a research project that's currently ongoing out of the University of British Columbia called the Digital Records Forensics Project. DRF is really an outshoot of the Inter Pares 1, 2, and the ongoing 3 research that we have been doing. In case you don't know, Inter Pares 1 and 2 really worked on developing the theoretical framework of what are the requirements for preserving electronic records. The major output of Inter Pares 2 was the chain of preservation model, which really, in amazing level of detail, really focuses on the inputs and the outputs of the entire record-keeping process, womb to tomb. If you haven't taken a look at that, highly recommend you view that. One of the partners that we were fortunate enough to really work with in Inter Pares 2 was the Vancouver Police Department. Very fortuitous circumstance, a officer who's in charge of the Financial Crimes Division happened to be sitting next to my professor, Dr. Luciana Durante, and said, "Wow, this archiving stuff's kind of cool. We have some problems with these electronic records, because with financial crimes, we will often accumulate hundreds of thousands of electronic pieces of evidence. We don't know what to do with them. Can you help us?" So they joined in on Inter Pares too, and were so impressed that, you mean there's somebody out there that knows how to preserve this electronic stuff, that they said, we really want to help and really want to continue, because this is a major issue. So now with ongoing Inter Pares 3, we're taking the theoretical framework and saying, how do we put it into implementation? One of our major partners is the Vancouver Police Department. In fact, we've expanded from the Financial Crimes Division to pretty much every single investigative unit there is. We're doing a very top-down analysis of their record-keeping processes, because we firmly believe that this is a largely untapped opportunity for archivists to really push out from being reactive, here's the stuff, to much more proactive in the entire chain of evidence. We have interviewed local and federal judicial officers, judges, court clerks. We have worked on regional and federal police departments, and we're finding that universally, cops are really good at busting the bad guys, but really bad at keeping paperwork. So there is a huge opportunity and a need there. If any of you saw the Washington Examiner on Wednesday, it's a free newspaper they circulate around here, headlines, great big bold point. 200 cases of rape case DNA evidence has been lost by the DC cops. Bright bold. You go in, it goes a little further. Yeah, evidence and electronic records have always been a weakness for the DC cops. Not an isolated case. They will all recognize that there is some need for help. What we're trying to instill on them is that archives and the law have gone together since the beginning of time. You know, the Roman tabularium was an incredibly important part of Roman society, the Republic and the Empire. The requirement to keep those records in a known, trusted third party in order to preserve their authenticity, that the reliability was based on the controlled form and structure of the documents themselves, that the archives was continued through legislation, public record laws, the Freedom of Information Act, dating all the way back to 1766 in Sweden, the concept of respecta fons, that archival science at its very core is a legal science and should be fully integrated in the legal system, including the maintenance of evidence and the laws of evidence. This also ties in very closely with the concept of diplomatics, that the study of the formal characteristics of the structure, the transmission, and the legal consequences of the records is a very important aspect, that the study of handwriting, symbols, seals, and the form and structure of the document itself is an important part of the record and needs to be analyzed as such. You can't rely just on the textual criticism, the content of the record itself, because while the content may be accurate, the document may be a forgery. So you need to understand these other sciences in order to really help establish the trustworthiness of the document itself. So currently, as archivists, we have this genre that we operate within using some diplomatics, some history of law, some administrative histories of the disciplines themselves in order to form what we know as professionals. That works really well, but it's not quite enough to operate in the 21st century. Because today, as archivists, we're often being called upon to become forensic experts. How do you know that record is authentic? How do you know it's trustworthy? Well, it was in a box of records somebody gave us. Maybe, maybe not. But how do we do that with electronic records now? We're having a hard enough time just accumulating, organizing, and keeping on a retention schedule electronic records, let alone having to establish their identity as evidence admissible in a court of law. And conversely, where we're not there to serve as the experts, unfortunately, digital forensics experts are being called upon to be archivists, to store this information, to preserve this information, to keep it for the long term. One of the issues that we ran across in an unnamed police department is they were doing GPS tracking of a suspect. They had actually placed a GPS unit into his vehicle, unknown to him, and were tracking his movements over a course of almost 3 years. That was great. Things happened. He went to jail on unrelated crimes. He came back out. He was still a suspect on the crimes that they were investigating. As it went forward and they were ready to prosecute and actually bring the case to trial, the GPS tracking software that they had used was on a no longer supported version of a major operating system. They couldn't bring the evidence up. Fortunately, the suspect was involved in a shooting and the case kind of resolved itself. But it really highlights the issue of particularly ongoing investigations that may take 10, 15 years to come to fruition. What do they do with this evidence? What they're doing now is they're putting it on CD and putting it in the paper case file and pushing it off-site. That is not a good example of forensic experts being archivists. So there is really this strong need and opportunity for us to step up so that we can help train them on the concepts of trustworthiness, reliability, authenticity, integrity, and really bring to them our expertise while we conversely can learn from them about their concepts and their needs and how they collect and store this electronic evidence so that we can better serve them as well. Which really brings us to the concept of trustworthiness, particularly in the digital realm. That reliability, how can we show that this record electronically, every time we reassemble those ones and zeros, will give us the same concept, the same view, the same human-represented interpretation of that binary data. That the information contained in that record is indeed accurate. That it is precise, it is correct, it is truthful, it is free of error or distortion. That none of those ones and zeros have been altered or changed. That the authenticity, that record is what it purports to be. That we can prove it, and that we can show that the integrity is there. And most importantly, help teach digital forensic experts that authentication and authenticity are two different things. Authentication is really the proof of authenticity that is provided by a witness, that somebody says, yes, that is the same record. Slightly different than authentic, which this is the record that it purports to be. So the objectives of the Digital Records Forensics Project are first and foremost to develop the concepts of, and methods that will allow archives, the judicial, the law enforcement to all agree on what a record is among all this digital stuff that's hanging out there. Particularly, there's a huge opportunity to educate the judicial system. Judges, in particular, are the last bastion of the Luddites. They have very little understanding of technology. We had one case that we were watching very closely where a gentleman decided to represent himself in a court case on a computer forensic crime. And he told the judge, if only I had the batch files off of my computer, I could prove my innocence. And the judge had absolutely no idea what a batch file was. So he turned to the prosecution and said, you need to give him all the batch files off of that computer. And they just said, okay. It was just total BS. The defendant was just trying to do anything he could to save himself, and the judge had no clue whatsoever. So helping them understand what is a record, what is the trustworthiness aspect of that record, what is really needed and what is not, is a huge opportunity for us to really help educate them. They would like to do it. We've talked to quite a few Supreme Court justices all the way down to regional court justices, and they want to know. They just don't want to admit that they don't know. We also are trying to develop the concepts and methods to determine how is that record authentic after it's been removed from its original environment. Because when you take a record out of the system it was developed and store it someplace else, how do you prove that chain of custody? How do you prove the integrity of that record as it was transmitted is intact, that that record is still authentic and is what it purports to be? And to grab onto that, to develop how you can extract these records from a digital system and still maintain that integrity. That's going to be one of the biggest challenges that we have yet still to face. And also to identify, develop, and organize, for us, the theoretical and methodological content for this new discipline called digital records forensics. What does it take for us as archivists to really move into the digital forensics field so that we can provide our expertise, blend it with what they know, and really help them preserve evidence with its integrity intact for the long term? So in order to do this, we have already started out by doing a large analysis of some of the literature that's out there in both the legal field, the computer science field, the forensics field, and also in the archives field. We have a fairly comprehensive bibliography with annotations on the Digital Records Forensics website. So you can already go out there and see what we have learned. We've read hundreds of articles. We've tossed out half of them as just really too technical or not pertinent to what it is we are covering, and we've put the best of the best up there. So if you really want to start coming up to speed, great place to go. We created a questionnaire that was really targeted towards several different sectors: court clerks, judges, forensic experts, police officers, records managers, and said, what are some of the pain points that you're encountering when dealing with evidence, digital evidence? Help us understand where there's some gaps that we can help fill. That questionnaire is still ongoing. The results of it, again, are being posted to the website. As we're doing these transcriptions and we're allowed, we're putting the transcriptions out on the website as well, so you can also read what it is we're covering. We did an ethnographic analysis of the procedures within the Vancouver Police Department to help understand what are your current processes, what's working, what's not. A lot of it's not working. A lot of it is, again, CD, paper file sent off-site. That's the process. We're trying to examine some of the digital evidence and identify some of the records that have been preserved to find out what is the process. How does it map to the chain of preservation model that was created in Inter Pares II, and where can we really help move that along so that it will be able to preserve the records, the electronic records, the evidence, and present it in court 10 or 15 years from now. And take everything that we've learned ultimately to help create a new program within the archival stream that really focuses on the rules of evidence and the preservation of electronic records. So the biggest lessons that we've learned when it comes to dealing with police, comes to dealing with digital forensics, is they don't have a clue what a record is. None whatsoever. If it's electronic, it's a record. There is no concept that some things are records and some things aren't. It's just whatever we have, we get, and that's what we deal with. That each individual unit from major crimes, homicide, petty theft, burglaries, each of these units are very, very insular. There is no cross-pollination in how they do things. Each unit develops its own processes and procedures, and that's just the way the unit works. There is really no hierarchical structure that they all ultimately report to, although there is a lot of strength in the fact that the police are very much a militant society. You have your sergeants, you have your captains, you have your chief, and what the chief says goes. So there's opportunity there. If you can get the chief to say, yes, we really need to do this, all the rank and file say, sir, yes, sir, and they move forward with it. But it's getting them to that point that's going to be the biggest challenge for us. We found that major crimes tend to be the most highly refined unit, and mostly because they deal with kidnappings and homicides, so some of the most important heinous crimes, and as a result, they have a highly defined process in place. Major crimes units, particularly Canada-wide, has a very structured way of dealing with how they create records and how they store records and what folders and how they call them. So they are the ones to really build the basis off of and trickle down some of that process that they have to some of the other units. There's a lot of need to know in the police department. We interviewed one organization that was covert ops that was so covert we couldn't even see them. They were one floor up, and they called us by telephone. So there's a lot of challenge there. Some of this is highly sensitive, and they are very, very secretive. They don't even let anybody outside of their insular unit know they exist. Nobody within the police department knows that these three guys that bug houses, what they look like. Because they just, you know, I think they walk in with a little bag over their head or something. There's no preservation planning. Probably not going to come as a surprise. They just don't understand. What do you mean that CD is not going to be good 10 or 15 years from now? You mean I need an operating system and a program to be able to read this data? Well, we had that GPS stuff. We thought it would work. And again, very insular. They each do it their own way. So they each have their own little stash that they hide. One of the most intriguing things for us that we found out is when a police officer moves from one unit to the next, he takes his records with him. They are so personal about these cases. They will not let them go. If I investigated this case, I am going to stick with it to the bitter end. I don't care if it's 15 years from now. I'm going to carry that case file with me no matter where I go. Which also means that whoever comes in to fill their place is denied those records because it's the one extant example of that record. So there's a lot of understanding that needs to be fostered in the field. And so what we would like to see it go is really to incorporate the diplomatic concepts, the laws of evidence, to have a firm understanding of digital forensics and also information and cybersecurity. To understand the concepts of the computer systems and how records move around and what does it take to prove the integrity of the records themselves to really form this new discipline of digital records forensics. And then build a stream in the archives program so that individuals who are specifically interested in this and have the skill set can really focus specifically on digital evidence. So, for more information, I'm going to send you to these websites. Inter Pares has an incredible amount of information on digital preservation. Digital Records Forensics, again, It's an ongoing project. We still have another year. We're putting much more information out as we move along. The first year was mostly what is it we're trying to do to really formulate the basis of the plan. This past year, we've been doing a lot of the research. We're starting to put those findings out there now. And also, you can look at the School of Library Archives and Information Studies at UBC. So, thank you very much. Here is my email. If any of your questions either aren't going to be asked, you don't want to ask, or you think of something later, here's how you get a hold of me. Thank you.
So today I'm going to be talking about the importance of contextual information for scientific data, including the types of contextual information that are captured by scientists, the purposes of their capture of contextual information, the ways in which the information captured differs between scientists in the same lab group, and some of the reasons for those differences. So understanding the context in which scientific data are created is crucially important. The preservation of contextual information has been emphasized by archivists, particularly for digital records. If people are going to understand records over time, they need to know the activities for which they were originally created. Contextual information for scientific data is particularly important because of the potential for reuse of data by scientists to arrive at new findings in their field. Without adequate documentation, as Christine Borgman has argued, data are just strings of numbers, variables, images. As we surveyed the literature on contextual information for archival materials, we were struck by how often the focus was on the records rather than on the processes that created them. Digital preservation literature, in particular the literature on the significant properties of digital records, has often focused on the records rather than on the activities surrounding their creation and use. The concept of context is often reduced to a set of seemingly easy to identify attributes, such as who, when, and why, that can often be gleaned from the documents themselves. Few researchers have focused on what constitutes contextual information for scientific data from the perspective of scientists. So to learn more about the capture of contextual information for scientific data, we conducted a case study of a 9-person material science lab group at a large U.S. research university. Material science is a field of engineering and applied science that examines the properties of and characteristics of matter. The group that we studied carried out research on semiconductors, which are commonly used in electronic devices. Over a 4-month period last summer, we conducted interviews with 5 graduate student members of the lab group and the faculty member who leads it. We asked them about their work, the data they created, and the kinds of things they did with the data after collecting them. We also examined the data that they produced, asking them to walk us through some part of their data collection, management, or retrieval process. We documented these sessions in field notes and took photographs of relevant visual and textual material. So the members of this lab group researched the surface structures of 3-5 semiconductors, compounds of elements from group 3 and 5 of the periodic table. Gallium arsenide, for instance, is a compound of the elements gallium and arsenic used by several members of the group. It's used in the manufacture of devices such as LEDs, solar cells, and microwave frequency integrated circuits. While there are practical applications for the work done by this group, their research is more concerned with the behavior of these compounds as they seek to understand how to control growth and force different kinds of structures to develop on the surface of the compounds. So a molecular beam epitaxy, or MBE, chamber was a commonly shared tool in the lab members' experiments. Scientists used this equipment to deposit very thin layers, hundreds of nanometers thick, of single crystals onto a substrate material. The lab members referred to the process of depositing these layers as growing a sample, and when they talked about running experiments, this was often the first step. A growing session typically took several hours to an entire day to complete, with some analysis occurring during this phase of the experiment. So here's an example of some data produced by this lab. Reflection high energy electron diffraction, or REED, is a technique used to characterize the surface of crystalline materials. REED systems gather information only from the surface layer of the sample. The REED device is attached to the MBE chamber, that's what I showed on the previous slide. This top picture is an actual image taken from the Reed device, and the bottom image is an intensity graph derived from the location of the line in the top picture, telling the scientist about the roughness of the surface. Here's some more data, data types that we have that are mostly images. So after the sample was grown, lab members carried out different characterization techniques on their sample. These are observations and measurements of the materials. Some examples are transmission electron microscopy and scanning tunneling microscopy. This primarily resulted in image data such as the images that you see here. So they would then analyze these images and frequently transform them into other types of data such as numeric data and graphs, which helped them identify the relationships between variables. During all stages of this process, they recorded information about their data. They were conscientious about documenting their data so that they could access them in the future. We found that in talking to the scientists about their data, it was important for all of them to manage their data in ways that would facilitate their own continued access to them. Information like research questions, experimental conditions, and research goals were vital for understanding their data over time. As one lab member put it, I need to understand what it was I was attempting to do and how I took the data. Well, their data activities sometimes served the needs of the group, and I'll give it an example in a moment of that. They were primarily suited to individual scientists' needs. We observed a shared concern to understand and retrieve data into the future, but a variation in the practices themselves that can be explained in large part by individual expertise, preferences, skills, and the purpose of the scientist's data collection. There were shared and individual factors that influenced what they judged as relevant context for their purposes. So here's a chart depicting what we see as the most influential factors in the scientist context. The members of the lab group shared both discipline and lab context. Their discipline, material science, has norms for the kind of information to present with data and also influences the questions that researchers ask. As members of this particular lab group, they shared some equipment and study a particular class of materials. They are also expected to record some select information that they all use as a reference. At an individual level, each is focused on specific research questions, particular materials, or combinations thereof within the 3-5 semiconductors that I talked about before. Each scientist also employs certain methods and conducts particular analyses, which helps them develop a specific set of skills. So the scientist context share similarities and also differ. Additionally, while some of their contexts may be shared, each judges aspects of that context as more or less relevant to their work. That is to say that context is the circumstances that form the setting for the data, but context also refers to the knowledge and intentions of the person creating the data, as well as of the person who might use those data. The scientists we studied focused their documentation practices on identifying the relevant information at the time that they produced the data, imagining what they, as users, would need to know about the data when they attempted to analyze and use them later. As a means of understanding the subjective nature of context for scientific data, I'm going to talk about lab members' individual motivations for data documentation and their specific practices. So in our interviews with the lab members, we learned about their motivations for documenting data, two of which I'll discuss here. One of the reasons they went to the trouble to document their data was so they could find the data later on. A second reason was to help them remember in the future what they did to produce the data. Scientists in this lab created many images for a given sample, as we can see in this slide here. These are all images for one sample. They needed to locate their data files and information about them in a way that was easy and quick to aid further analysis and to use the images in publications and presentations. In addition to being able to find the data, they also needed to understand what processes and circumstances were associated with the data weeks, months, and sometimes even years later. One way in which they accomplished both of these things, to aid in retrieval and their own understanding, was through the use of file names to describe the data. All of the members made use of the file names for this purpose, but the end result could be quite different. So here are three file names, each taken from a different scientist in the group. One thing that all the file names across users had in common was the sample number, which you see here. Any piece of data associated with a sample had the sample number put in the file name. The sample number is an alphanumeric combination. The letter designates growths occurring after a particular vent of the chamber, so that with each venting of the chamber, the letter changed. This was important information for the lab members to know, as it could explain some discrepancies in the samples and the data derived from them. This letter is always followed by a number that was an ordered number of the sample, such as E2509 that we see here. In this case, the next sample grown in the chamber, no matter who in the group grew it, would be E2510, unless, of course, the chamber was vented, in which case it would be F2510. This sample numbering system also helped the scientists to find all files associated with the sample. But the lab members also used the file names to record information about the data file and sample beyond the number. All of the scientists we talked to in this group recorded different kinds of information here in varying ways. Bill included variables such as substrate temperature, fluxes of the various elements, rates of deposition, and a quick name to say, okay, what was this trying to prove, or what kind of experiment was this for? In this example file that you see at the top, the first number is the image number, which starts at 00 and is incremented with each saved image. The second number is the sample number. The third is the image size along one side. In this case, this one is 500 angstroms by 500 angstroms. And the fourth and fifth are the X and Y positions on the sample. The seventh term is the scan rate, so how quickly the STM, the instrument tip, was moved along the surface. The eighth and ninth are the tunneling voltage and current, and after that, any other special conditions, such as if the image was taken from a particular spot. In this case, there are 1,024 scan lines instead of the usual 512, so he's designated this in the file name. Susan, the second example that we see here, aimed to keep her file names, quote, somewhat short and just keep the most relevant variables in the file name. For her, this meant variables like increased dwell time and change in temperature. In this example file, she has the sample name, then the thickness in monolayers of indium arsenide. PL means that the sample is ready for a photoluminescent study and that there are 500 nanometers of gallium arsenide in the sample. The last example is from Thomas, a second-year student, who described his own file names as being long and complicated. In this example, 2009-0716 is the date of the imaging, 3011 is the instrument he took the images with, FIB-038 is the sample identifier. In this case, it's his own sample numbering, not the group numbering, because he hasn't grown anything in the chamber yet. B3 is the FIB pattern and the section of the sample that he took the analysis from. On and on, 30KX indicates that the image was taken at a magnification of 30,000. So, context is not a given. Some of the variations in data management practices, including how data are documented, is likely due to personality differences and the fact that the lab had imposed no specific system on the group. However, much of the variation can be explained by the influence of learning over time and the scientists' particular research questions. The scientists we interviewed talked about a process of trial and error, whereby they learned what information was important for them to document so that they could effectively use their data. This experiential component was also evident in the file naming conventions described by and later observed of lab members who were at different stages of their graduate careers. The research direction of the two newest members, Bill and Thomas, was not as solidified as those who were nearing graduation. While they had specific research areas, they were still trying to narrow down their focus and determine which aspects of the research area were most interesting and promising. Both said they were unsure exactly what information they would need later. In other words, what specific variables would eventually be their main focus of inquiry. They recorded extensive information in their file names relative to other lab members because they wanted to try to ensure that they had access to valuable information later, whatever it turned out to be. Contrast this with Keith, who said in describing what information he captures, I'm probably just one of the ones who, you know, I guess after being here 6 years, I just write down whatever I need to and just go for it. Just writes down, and then compared to Susan, who was also about to finish, described a minimalist approach to her file naming. Well, these examples demonstrate that inexperience and learning affect how lab members conceive of relevant context and determine what is worth capturing. They also show the importance of research questions in making those determinations. The scientists we studied were always ultimately interested in the correlation between different variables. Examples include how surface reconstruction varied with changes in temperature and surface thickness, how a particular method of altering the surface affected the photoluminescence of the material, and how cutting different shapes in the materials altered the strain or stress seen in a thin film. While there are likely many more variables related to these data, the scientists were interested in the variables that addressed their questions. Through practice and trial and error, they learned what those were, in addition to learning which associated information was needed to present their results. Shankar states that record keeping in science is by necessity a creative and personalized set of practices. Our case study demonstrates that these practices are based largely on scientists' research questions and experience. Knowing important contextual information about data is an integral part of scientific work, yet scientists often only capture the information that is relevant to their research at that time. Because of these individual formulations of context, archivists will not be able to base determinations of what contextual information is worthy of preservation exclusively on data types, particular scientific domains, or even specific labs. If archivists want to ensure continuing access to scientific data, they should begin by turning their attention to the activities that generate the records and not just the records themselves. In doing so, they go against the assumption that just because they have identified and preserved the information scientists captured for the data, that those data can travel freely from the context of creation to be used by other scientists. Data documentation is bound up in scientists' particular research needs. While their data could conceivably be of use to other scientists, what they document about the data may be insufficient for these new uses. I just want to thank these people. Thank you.
Well, I think you can see from these presentations the range of research interests that are unfolding within the broader archival academic community. Three different areas of interest, three different contexts of interest, and a variety of approaches to those interests. And all of these papers I thought were outstanding. I hope you agreed. We do have time for questions and comments, reaction and feedback. I do want to remind you that the entire session, including the question, which will be repeated by me, is being audio recorded. So again, please give your congratulations to the three speakers. Are there any questions for Sarah, Adam, or Dharma?
Please. Question for Adam.
Could you please give us your name?
Sue Hamburger, Penn State.
So Sue Hamburger from Penn State is interested in how the police can be educated in effectively implementing.
So the way we see it working is, first off, it's going to be a two-pronged attack. One, we have to educate the judges, because the judges are going to require higher standards of conduct. And secondly, there is opportunity in the police academies to actually get in there and at least expose them to these concepts. For instance, the forensic units for the Vancouver Police Department actually have FaceTime in the police department, the police academy, to help the patrol officers, the junior cadets who will become patrol officers, understand that you just can't break down the door, grab a computer, unplug it, and bring it in as evidence. That there are certain procedures you're going to have to follow. But ultimately, those that do the digital forensics is only a very small portion of the police units. So the way we see it actually working is when somebody's brought into a forensic unit, part of their on-the-job training will be an understanding of what it is that digital preservation really entails. You just can't throw it on a CD and push it out. Ultimately, where we would like to see it go, though, is that the preservation aspects of evidence would be really the responsibility of the unit archivist, of the digital records forensics expert, that they understand that cops are very good at busting bad guys but very bad at keeping paperwork, that let's bring in somebody whose expertise is keeping that paperwork, those electronic files. How do we educate the judges? The judges actually have off-site retreats specifically to educate themselves on various topics of the day. It's usually done either quarterly or every 6 months. We've already made some initial forays into finding out what it takes to present to them. There is interest. They do want to know. They don't want a whole lot of detail, but they at least want to know conceptually, what questions should I be asking? They don't want to appear like they're stupid, that they don't know. But if we can at least give them the right questions, well, how can you prove the integrity of that electronic record? Then at least it gives them some exposure to what they should have the defense or the prosecution present to them, either in court or as a sidebar, so that they can educate themselves, so they can have the right answer, so that they can know.
So that was a good question about how to educate the officers and the judges in digital forensics techniques. A question in the back.
I have a question about the science paper.
Could you please say who you are for?
Oh, sorry. My name is Shirley Nichols. I'm from Jet Propulsion Labs.
Shirley Nichols from Jet Propulsion Labs.
Yeah. I think this is more in the context of thinking about people that would be basically in charge of, you know, data curation or running these big scientific databases. And so an outstanding question is, how do you share data between scientists? And I guess what we found most interesting in this lab group is that they couldn't even really share between themselves, like, over time, because there were these striking differences. So I think more, like, in terms of practice, our recommendations would go more into, like, designing systems or actually working with the people in the labs to design a system of capturing that information up front. What's that? No, it has to be part of... Yeah, exactly. That's... No, it's a huge issue. It has to, definitely has to be... it has to integrate with their work practices. But I think more than anything, we were just trying to reveal that you can't... Like, that sometimes when archivists talk about context, there's just such a focus on, like, well, what context from these records needs to be captured? And it's really not going to cut it for reuse of data. And so that's kind of like our main point, I think, is kind of revealing that. No, I think it's got to be a change in how it's recorded.
I'm going to propose that from here on, the person receiving the question summarize the question that they heard, so that can be that was my job. But I'm going to switch it to you folks so that the people here know what you think they're asking. So when you receive a question, please be sure to summarize your understanding of that question, and that way we can also get it recorded. Question here.
My name is Crystal. I'm from Brown. I have a question for Sarah. One of the students who could be visually impaired, someone, what kind of accommodations do you think for them or other students with special needs that can participate in the activity?
Yes, so as I heard the question, what are the types of accommodations we can make for people with different abilities? We actually did have a student come in last semester that did have a vision impairment. He was, I guess, almost completely blind. He could just see colors. So what I did was I went and contacted his teacher of record, and then I had her contact his special education teacher to see if there were any special accommodations that needed to be made ahead of time. It's something that we kind of had thought about before, but the planning of special needs accommodations hasn't been especially easy in our institution because we don't have the funding for a lot of special equipment. So what we really do is we try to consult the teacher ahead of time on any of their forms when they apply to come for a seminar. We have that listed on there, and then we get in contact with them. This young man actually did not want any additional accommodation made for him. And so what we did is we had a reader kind of describe some of the slides and things that we show at the beginning of our program, and then during the portion where they come in and work with the actual archival material, he was actually able to provide some insights that other people really weren't with his abilities as well. So I guess just really contacting teachers ahead of time and really knowing what to expect, being prepared to set up early if you need to bring in special equipment for them and that type of thing. Thank you.
Other questions or feedback for presenters? Please.
I'm Deb Torres from St. Catherine University. I have a question for Adam. Adam, you said that the police officers considered everything to be a record. Could you expand on that and give some details about what is the everything that they consider to be a record? Or did you mean that, did they consider everything to be evidence?
So the question was to expand upon my comment that the police officers consider everything to be a record. And did they really mean evidence or did they mean record? So my answer to that is the core issue is they don't understand what a record is. If you ask them, what records do you create, what records do you keep, everything is a record. Because that concept of what the definition of a record, something made or received in the course of business and kept for evidence of further activity, they don't get that. Evidence, record, to them, they're synonyms. everything is a record. Everything is evidence. So trying to get them to understand, even within their own work, some stuff has long-term value, some stuff is transitory and is just junk, you don't keep it. They just don't get it. They don't understand. It's not something they've ever had any exposure to at all. So the question is, what is the implication of them not having an understanding of the concept of record? Well, the implication is they're keeping a lot more stuff than they ever really need to. And considering they're having difficulties just preserving the evidence for their case, it trickles down. It just compounds the problem of, okay, we've kept all the stuff we have to, and now we've kept all the stuff we don't have to, so what do we do? You know, their resources are extraordinarily limited. The Vancouver Police Department just installed more sand storage because financial crimes, for instance, picks up hundreds of thousands of financial transaction records for each case. They already have a backlog of 20 terabytes of information that they're keeping resident on small portable hard drives that they really need to move to a more secure location. But they've already filled up their yearly allotment of sand storage. So the problem is they have so much stuff that it, sorting through it is very difficult for them. So the question is, State Archives already has tens of thousands of boxes of legal files in their collection. What is the trend, if any, toward going more electronic and more virtual in that? And what we are seeing now is there is a huge trend to take paper files and make them electronic from an access standpoint. The judges are finally starting to accept and understand and actually appreciate the ability to call up case files directly from the bench. As things are going on, they can pull it up and look. So we think that that trend is absolutely going to continue, that moving from a paper environment to electronic is going to be inevitable, simply from a cost, storage, and efficiency standpoint, that they most of the court clerks are taking paper and they are scanning it. Things are being handed in paper still, printed out copies of emails still, but those copies are then being put back into an electronic format. The forensic units, for instance, are taking hard drives, they're making images of the hard drives and turning in those images to the defense electronically. So, and they see that continuing because some of the content can only be handled and effectively used electronically. So inevitably, those paper files are going to just sit and more of it is going to be electronic only. Much easier to deal with in some ways, much more difficult in others. So better start ramping up that storage.
I have a question for you, Sarah.
Okay.
You said in the course of your presentation, and I think it's something that most people who work in any kind of archival, archival collection have experienced, and it is one of the thrills of the profession. You commented that there were a number of instances where you saw in the students that were there an aha moment. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you would be willing to share one of those moments with us so that we could have a better understanding of how that happened in that setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I see a lot of aha moments, especially when the kids come down and actually work with the primary documents. I think one of my favorite moments is when we had the students come down in the same group with the student that had a visual impairment. And it was really neat to see the interaction of him and the documents, because he was experiencing those documents in a completely different way. He had to kind of ask some of his buddies and stuff exactly what was going on. There was a time when he picked up a document and I saw everyone else cringe because of the way that he was kind of holding it. And he really had a unique perspective on the document itself. When we were talking about the differences in paperweight and those types of things, he could really provide a unique perspective on that. And he was really interested in the content as well. And I think a lot of times the students will get really excited about kind of being on a field trip and not really pay attention to the content or what's really being talked about. And he really had to listen carefully. And he would provide just a kind of a lot of insights for a lot of the other students. And so through his aha moment, he was able to provide like an additional aha moment for the kids. So he was as much, I think, of as an educator in that situation as I was. And I think the students that left that day had a great experience. They got to see really old stuff, and they thought it was really cool in that regard. They got to do some document analysis, but I think they got to really experience the document experience through somebody else as well.
So we have a little bit more time for a few more questions or any additional feedback. Yes, sir.
My name is Ryan Sims from Mississippi University.
Ryan Sims from Mississippi State.
Sarah, you said that...
Yes, so the question is, in our experiences, do we find that we would possibly have an older education group for this? Well, we actually do something kind of similar to that when we bring students and teachers in for teacher workshops. We've recently included teachers or people who are studying to become teachers. And we've really seen that since those people have been involved, the discussions have really changed. We have classroom teachers and then we have budding teachers. We do a lot of the activities with them. We do simulate part of the seminar, but that is a really great point. Maybe just put them through the entire seminar. That would be really an exciting opportunity as well. During the teacher workshop, we usually will share different methodologies and then we will have them try them out and then kind of brainstorm and discuss different things and ways that they have used those methodologies in their own classroom and in their own studies. And this fall, I actually have a teacher from a local high school, the one that was brought on through our Park Foundation grant. She's actually teaching a large portion of the workshop. She has many years teaching experience, teaching AP US and other advanced history courses, and she's really good at teaching document-based questions. And we've had a huge response from teachers already with our Save the Date on document-based questions. It's a skill that students are starting to learn in middle school, and then if they are going on to proceed to the AP US History exam, they're required to do those to pass out of early history courses and their college experience. So I think that's a great thing to really consider on our part. I think we really should possibly put them through the whole program so they can really get the experience that the students will get. We do put them through small activities, and I think they feel that the document experience is the main thing. So even though we have these traveling archives boxes, taking them out into the classroom just isn't quite the same as coming in and touching the real thing.
Other questions, comments, or feedback? Well, I have one more question. This would be for you, Dharma, and you might choose to answer it as well, Adam. Trone Jacobson from the University of Michigan. It is the case that both of you are interested in preservation. Morgan might want to pick up on this as well. Preservation of important information that is unique to a particular field. But it's sometimes the case, and maybe increasingly the case, that people outside of the field in which that information was originally produced have an interest in that. So, for example, a professor at the School of Information as a historian has been using primary scientific data to construct a history of science and technology. Or other individuals, historians, anthropologists, citizens might be interested in legal evidence, not just as it might be used in a court of law. So I'm curious for either of you, I realize it's hard to anticipate potential future uses by unknown people down the road, but I'm curious if those kinds of questions have entered into your approach to the research that you've undertaken, if at all.
No.
Yes.
I have the fortunate circumstance of having worked at the Washington State Digital Archives, where one of the earlier record series we brought in was the Frontier Justice Files. That was a complete index of the prosecution, defense, and the type of crime of territorial Washington case files. So from that perspective, I can carry that understanding into the more current
case files on the need to have that historical perspective to understand what were the times really like. It was interesting looking through the Frontier Justice files at 14-year-olds being charged with underage drinking, of brandishing a firearm in public. You know, this is supposed to be the wild, wild west, right? And people were filing for divorce and underage drinking and using a gun in public. But isn't that what they all do? They ride into town and shoot their guns. So it really has provided an interesting perspective, particularly in some of the outreach education that we do, of that Washington State does, of helping educate students of what the times were really like using actual real case files. So we can do that 100, 200 years from now of what was the 21st century really like. Well, let's look at the case file, shall we?
So I was being kind of facetious. I think we didn't really actually, it's hard for me to consider other possible future uses just because the problems of just sharing in the group were so pronounced. And I think that some of the value that the lab head sees in terms of like being able to preserve this data in a way that is actually accessible to other people is being able to identify trends. You know, she pointed out the fact that they often do experiments with kind of like one focus, but that there's a lot of data that could potentially be captured by that if it was captured in like the appropriate way. So I think that we were just so mired in those challenges that it's hard for me to conceive beyond those walls.
So let's thank all three of them again. It's been great season two. Thank you.